From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. It's starting tomorrow and for a week, a little rare vacation for me, and we'll have a few best of shows and three guest hosts sometime next week filling in for me. Chris McGill, he hosts his own paranormal show in Kentucky, Hilly Rose, and Ian Punnett. Remember Ian? So all three of them will fill in for me next week. And congratulations tonight to the San Antonio Spurs, NBA champs, defeating my Detroit Pistons. Final game, 81-74. They are jumping for joy in San Antonio right now. Next hour, God, Man, E.T., a major roundtable discussion with David Flynn, author of Cydonia, The Secret Chronicles of Mars, Mike Heiser, The Facade, Hugh Ross, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, and then Richard C. Hoagland, EnterpriseMission.com. And Richard put this together for us, did some yeoman's work there. Cities, listen to this one now. Cities may bulldoze your home to make way for shopping malls or other private development. A divided Supreme Court made that ruling, giving local governments broad power to seize private property to generate tax revenue. In a scathing dissent, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, and good for her, said this decision bowed to the rich and powerful at the expense of middle-class Americans and poor people. The 5-4 decision means that homeowners will have limited rights. And still, legal experts say they didn't expect a rush to claim homes. But can you imagine that? Cities can just say, all right, you know, beyond eminent domain and all that stuff that goes on and these little councils and these city councils, now with the Supreme Court backing them up, they can just simply go and seize your home because they think it's right in the way of some kind of major development. Man, this is one of the worst decisions I've ever heard. Federal drug agents launched a wide-ranging crackdown on medical marijuana providers in Northern California, arresting at least 17 people in San Francisco and Sacramento. Now, according to the DEA, though, they say, now, wait a minute, this has been an investigation into a marijuana and ecstasy trafficking ring. This is not just about medical marijuana. Believe who you want, but that's what happened today. A former IRS agent who believes citizens are not required to pay federal income taxes was acquitted on charges he attempted to defraud the government. His name's Joseph Bannister. He is a CPA. Lives in San Jose, California. He had been telling his clients that they didn't need to file federal income tax returns because the 16th Amendment, which gives Congress the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes, was never properly ratified. A leading figure in the tax honesty movement, Bannister was taken into custody on November 19th by the IRS agents, released on $25,000 bond after he pleaded not guilty. Well, a jury in U.S. District Court in Sacramento has now found him not guilty on a charge of conspiracy and all three counts of aiding and assisting the filing of false income tax returns for a client. This might have a bearing on a lot of things. Now, listen to this story. A Chinese state-controlled oil company has made an $18.5 billion unsolicited bid for Unocal, igniting the first-ever takeover battle between corporations in China and the United States. The bold bid by the China National Offshore Oil Corporation, and I'm sure that is not a private corporation, may be a watershed in Chinese corporate behavior, and it demonstrates the increasing influence of Wall Street's bare-knuckle tactics in Asia. The offer also illustrates how crucial oil and gas resources are to China, given its huge growth. Now, this bid comes 2 months after Unocal agreed to be sold to an American energy giant, Chevron, for $16.8 billion. So this could be a very fierce battle. But China now is beginning to use money that we probably have given them, because we're buying all their goods, to begin to buy U.S. companies. Very strange situation. Those of you who have been chatting on Yahoo, you're not going to be able to do that anymore. Yahoo, the most used internet site, has shut down all its user-created internet chat rooms amid concerns that adults were simply using the sites to try to have sex with minors. The giant internet media company closed down those chat rooms and the ability to create new ones. Now, some of you do chat listening to the show on Yahoo. You won't be able to do that anymore. So here's some places for you. First of all, Streamlink. That's the Coast to Coast Streamlink. You can get to it and join that if you want. You can do more than just chat, but there are message boards and things like that. So that's available to you. There's a great website called iwexplorers.com where you can become a member of that for free and chat because they listen to the program and they, you know, give us input and feedback. And then the fantasticforum.com. So those are a couple free chat rooms for you that listen to the show religiously. So those of you who might have been doing some Yahoo chatting, there's still a vehicle there for you. Sponsors of an experimental spacecraft designed to use light from the sun to power space travel have now conceded that the mission is probably lost. And if you go to the coasttocoastam.com website or also ctoc.com, we're making it easier for you, take a look at the story on the hot stories about the breakthrough that could change the lives of amputees, the ability to move artificial arms and possibly legs just by merely thinking about it with computers, and these are bionic arms and legs, and that's what makes it so incredible. In a moment, Linda Moulton Howe, our guest, as we talk about unusual animal deaths in Argentina and radar testing on Mars on Coast to Coast AM. Well, she's an investigative reporter. She looks at high strangeness all around this planet. Earthfiles.com editor Linda Moulton Howe. Linda, I'm going to let you get right into your report because this thing is unbelievable. Go ahead.
Well, you know, it's amazing to me to realize that starting today at 3 o'clock Pacific, for the first time in human history, we began looking underground with radar on another planet in our solar system. And 11 days from now, George, on July 4th, we're going to try to blast into a comet for the first time in human history to see what happens and what it's made of. And I'm going to be talking about those outer space adventures in the second half hour tonight. But back on Earth, from Canada to South America, something very strange continues to kill and mutilate animals around the world. And I've told you on Coast before that before he died, United States Army Lieutenant Colonel Philip Corso told me that when he was serving in the Eisenhower administration after World War II, that he had seen with his own eyes these highly classified documents about unusual worldwide animal deaths that had bloodless excisions. And he said that in the government documents, they said the perpetrators, as early as 1951 date, were, quote, extraterrestrial biological entities, unquote. That's coming from a United States Army lieutenant colonel. Well, when I began investigating the animal mutilation mystery back in 1979 for the first time, and it was broadcast as that special, The Strange Harvest, right, what I constantly heard from law enforcement was their frustration in not finding blood, not finding tracks or any evidence around these bodies of these dead animals. And repeatedly, when you find that the same tissue that's taken is an ear, an eye, the jaw flesh, usually always on the same side of the head, the right or the left, the tongue removed deep in the throat, genitals and rectum and or vaginal tract cored out, and some excisions have been so perfectly round that law enforcement and ranchers have called them cookie cutter cuts. And that's what a rancher recently found on one of his 10-year-old cows in Paradise Hill. That's up in Saskatchewan, Canada, sort of northwest of Saskatoon. And this was only a couple of weeks ago on June 10th. And that rancher told me that the cow's udder was completely cut out in a perfect circle, and he compared for me that the circle, he said, if I got a 5-gallon can and I put it on the stomach of that cow and I drew a circle around it with a pencil, and then I had some way of perfectly cutting out only the hide and not even touching the muscle. He said that's what it looked like. And I have photographs of exactly this sort of thing in dozens and dozens of cases around the world. Well, the other thing that he pointed out was that a coyote, he actually saw a coyote in the distance, and it would not approach the body of this cow. The cow laid there for 5 days before any kind of predation. And when he looked in this tall grass around the body, he couldn't find any tracks of any kind. And this is why law enforcement has always kind of looked up to the sky for answers. And I personally have talked with, a dozen people who have seen beams come down in pastures. They've seen animals rise in the beams or be lowered back down to the pastures in the beams. And this might explain why a calf in Argentina had very clean hooves in an otherwise totally muddy pasture after rain. And this photo came to me today from Guillermo Jimenez, who works with a group in Buenos Aires to investigate animal mutilations there in that province. And this case sent to me, along with a lot of excellent photographs from that country, shows that all over the world, whether you're talking about Canada or the United States, England and other European countries, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, all of those countries, since at least the 1950s to the 1960s, have had these same kinds of strange animal deaths called mutilations by law enforcement. And you can see all of these new Argentina photographs in this recent Canadian case at my website, www.earthfiles.com. There are hot links at the top of the headlines page, and I think it's really worthwhile seeing these and making the comparisons in the photos. And George, here is a surprising statistic. The number of mutilation cases since 2002 in Argentina and Chile is now estimated to be 3,244 over just the past 3.5 years.
That's enormous.
Well, that's more than 900 a year in just those two countries alone. And along with these thousands of unusual animal deaths, Chile and Argentina eyewitnesses have also been reporting unidentified aerial objects and beams of light, despite the Argentina government's official explanation a couple of years ago for all of these animal deaths that do not stop is and was, believe it or not, what they call a red-snouted mouse. Now, that official proclamation made veterinarians laugh in Buenos Aires and La Pampa provinces.
I guess so.
They were doing necropsies there, and under a microscope, they were finding and reporting that many of the animal cuts had been made with high heat. Some kind of instrument has been cauterizing the tissue in all these animals, and as one farmer said to me on the phone with the translator, small red-snouted mice don't carry lasers. Well, I talked this week with Scott Corrales, who does Spanish-to-English translations about UFO phenomena at his Inexplicado website, and I asked him what so far in 2005 in South America has been the most dramatic incident tied to animal mutilations and beams of light, and here now is Scott Corrales.
It's a case from Argentina involving a man who was returning to his ranch after a family event on a muleback. And he's crossing a river that he describes as being not a very deep river, but a very wide river, and seeing strange lights downriver. And he sees the lights, having been accustomed to seeing them before, having tied them in with the animal, the cattle mutilations in La Pampa province. And he decided that it was time for him to spur that mule and cross that river as quickly as he could. But at some point, the mule got frightened. He fell into the river as these three large disc-shaped objects passed directly over him, scanning the ground with their beams, giving him the distinct impression they were looking for something. They pass him over, keep going upriver, and he sees them, you know, just, I guess, fade away at some point. But these objects, these saucers or lights or whatever you want to call them, structures, were distinctly looking for something. And it could have been a certain animal, it could have been a certain herd. That's just my conjecture. But that's the impression the witness was trying to convey.
That whatever was in those discs might have been actively looking for specific animals.
Absolutely.
To interact.
Whether it was one of his or one of those of a neighboring farm, he doesn't know. This man had, I think, lost, I'm trying to think. He lost an unspecified number of animals already. And he, even though it was just a very, very brief report, you could detect the sense of not I'm going to say hopelessness, but why even bother reporting anything to the authorities? Nothing gets done. The police will, unlike the Puerto Rican police in Chupacabra's years, they would dutifully fill out police complaints and take reports and file them. But there was nothing to be done in Argentina, certainly.
Right.
After the government had handed down the instruction, do not report this, we have already given you an answer. And yet, like Galileo said, e pur si muove, I mean, it's still happening.
Right.
The mutilations continue, the craft appear. Now, last month, there was a case that was straight out of the 1970s of two fellows driving along in a car, and they actually see beings, one of them descending along what they describe as a tube of light. And if there had been more information to that case, that would have certainly been the jewel in the crown for 2005. But they were driving past very quickly. They saw the object, saw the tube of light, saw one being on the ground and one being coming down the light beam. And they poured on the gas and just got out of there.
And George, I reported about such a similar sounding case in Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, my book in 1998. And that was up in Snohomish, Washington, where a fellow had been out just pulling weeds in a remote rural backyard when this big silver craft, he said, came right over the tall pine trees, made the pine trees move all over the place as if there was a wind, even though there was not a wind. And then to his complete and absolute astonishment, he said, I was absolutely frozen in place. He watched what looked like a beam of something. He couldn't say whether it was light, but it definitely he could see a beam coming down from this craft. And two, he called them, he said they looked sort of like Filipinos from a distance, but they were wearing tight blue jumpsuits. And both of these beings came down this light, and he tried to hide. It's a very long story, but that was back in the 70s in Washington. And further, the high strangeness in Argentina includes 3 years ago in Santa Rosa, in the area of La Pampa, 19 cattle were found inside of a water tank, and they'd been somehow taken from their pen and deposited inside of this open water tank.
Yeah, it's like the cows have learned how to climb, right?
Well, yeah, the farmer himself, who said when he was asked, he said, all I can tell you is I have no explanation, but someone took my animals up in the air and put them inside of that water tank by whatever means. Well, back in April to May 1977, there were a herd of 100 cattle that were transported from a farm in Wales in the British Isles to another farm half a mile away. And this kept going on for 2 months. 100 cattle in the night would be transported from one farm to another. The farmers were so upset. They had to go get their cattle. They had no explanation. At one point, they were humiliated because they couldn't get it stopped, and they couldn't explain it. And finally, all of this was documented in an excellent 1979 book called The Dyfed Enigma. And this means, George, that whatever this phenomenon, this beam technology is, it's functioning right now as we speak down in Argentina and Chile and maybe even across the river in Uruguay, and that these stories, the beams and the light, all of these mutilations, the beams searching for on cattle, all were happening just 3 or 4 weeks ago in May.
Well, sounds like they may have tested all this on Travis Walton many years ago too, Linda, huh?
Well, that's a whole different story.
Sure is. Well, when you come back, let's talk about this radar work on Mars. Linda Moulton Howe, our guest this hour on Coast to Coast AM. Incredible story about radar testing on Mars. We're going to chat with Linda Moulton Howe about that in just a moment. But I did want to tell you about the After Dark newsletter, where you get 14 issues for the price of 12 every month. All kinds of stories there, an editorial by me, this one on Dr. Morgus. Remember him? So make sure you take advantage of the 14 issues for the price of 12 deal by calling 1-888-727-5505 or go to coasttocoastam.com or CTOC. I like that now. CTOC.com. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest, Linda Moulton Howe. So, Linda, what's been going on in the world of science on Mars these days?
Well, I'll tell you, I learned something amazing today from the Mars Express Orbiter Spacecraft Operations Manager. He is Michel Denis. He's based at the European Space Agency's office in Darmstadt, Germany. And I was getting an update about the plans for the deep ground penetrating radar that was turned on today for the first time at 3 o'clock Pacific. And this is what he told me. A month ago, on May 7th, the Mars Express orbiter that's carrying the radar and NASA's two spacecraft, the Odyssey and the Mars Global Surveyor, could have collided.
Oh, my.
This is incredible. Mr. Denis said that, to their shock at ESA, that on April 29th, they received a call from NASA about calculations that showed all three spacecraft orbiters, two of ours from NASA and the one from ESA, would all three be going to their lowest point in orbit, about 250 to 300 kilometers above the Martian surface. And there could be an intersection point or collision on May 7th. And NASA asked ESA if they would actually change the orbit of the Mars Express orbiter slightly to avoid this potential catastrophe, and ESA did. But, George, who would think that with only three orbiters on Mars, you could periodically face a traffic jam?
I would never have imagined that.
Yeah.
I mean, everything we've got going around our planet, I'm not even sure we've had any collisions. I'm sure we've had close calls, but I've never heard of this.
Well, and at that same period of time, the Mars Global Surveyor was close enough to Odyssey and ESA's Mars Express to take some really cool photographs. These, in fact, are, to everybody's statement at NASA, these are the very first photographs ever taken by one orbiting spacecraft around another planet, in this case Mars, of two other orbiting spacecraft. And the photographs are really great, and I have them posted at Earth Files in my report tonight about getting the deep penetrating radar on Mars turned on. And so I recommend that people go and look at these photographs that we are taking up there of colleagues' spaceships, and knowing that they almost could have collided on May 7th in their lowest orbit point. Well, this week, to also find out about what was going to happen, because I've been waiting for a year thinking this is some of the most exciting solar system news there is going, what happens when they turn on that deep ground penetrating radar to look for possibly water ice, maybe even liquid water under pressure, underground, look for subterranean chambers, all of these things that have been being talked about. And we've been frustrated for an entire year that they couldn't get this radar turned on. And Michael McKay, who is the flight operations director for ESA, has explained to me that these three antenna that makes a radar work two are 20 meters long and one is 7 meters long. And they're made out of fiberglass and Kevlar. And a year ago, the manufacturer was afraid, based on some computer simulations they were running, that if they were unfurled in the current software that they had, that they might end up doing damage to the Mars Express orbiter, and that would have jeopardized all of the other important scientific instruments aboard, and they just couldn't make that decision. So for the past 12 months, they've been tweaking software, and finally, today was the first day of the radar operation in a test mode. And now for the next 10 days, it's called, officially, the Mars Advanced Radar for Subsurface and Ionosphere Sounding. And to make all that shorter, they call it MARSIS. It's going to be turned on 3 times a day to calibrate this very complicated instrument. And the whole goal now is, can it look down into 3 miles? This is 3 miles, George, 3 miles down, all the way around the surface of Mars, looking down through 3 miles of Martian crust. Can they find water ice or even liquid water under pressure? And one of the very interesting issues here is that atmospheric scientists such as Vittorio Formisano in Italy, who has been head of the PSF instrument looking at molecules in the Martian atmosphere, he wants to see if the radar could find any underground places that might contain ice or water that might match the regions in the Martian atmosphere that he has reported this year, a higher water molecule, methane, and possibly formaldehyde gas concentrations in the atmosphere above 3 regions along the Martian equator. And he thinks that there's a possibility that the higher gas concentrations in the air might be related to subsurface ice or even water at those depths. And now there's another problem.
What is that?
In order to do reasonably accurate deep ground penetrating radar investigation, the radar needs to be turned on when the Mars Express orbiter is at that closest point to the Martian surface, at 270 kilometers. Now, that only happens periodically in the spacecraft's very elliptical orbit. And that orbit, the ESA, Mars orbiter, goes from 270 kilometers, the closest over the surface, all the way out to 10,000 kilometers, highly elliptical orbit. And when that orbit is closest to the Martian ground, it needs to be nighttime so that the sunlight won't ionize the atmosphere and interfere with the radar's clarity. Now, by mid-July, when the orbiter is finally at its lowest orbital spots, and they've done all of this setting it up and tuning it up and making sure everything is working okay, it's going to be Martian sunlight. Now, this is just one of those fluky things that, because of the year delay and all of this has been thrown off, it won't be now until early December that the lowest points of the Mars Express orbiter will finally match up with Martian nights. And that's when the real science will begin. But both Michael McKay and Michel Denis told me that within the next 2 to 3 weeks, they are going to do some deep penetrating radar. They may release some press releases by mid-July on something. It may have to do only with the instrumentation, but everything, so everyone will understand, we go into another blank mode, July to the 1st of December, simply because the orbit and the sunlight will be not in the right partnership. But I ask Michael McKay, he's been living with all of the engineering problems on getting the MARSIS radar going. Everybody has been excited to get this radar looking into the crust of Mars. And I ask him if he personally expects the MARSIS radar to find a lot of water ice underground in the 3 miles of Martian crust that the radar can explore.
Here it is.
I personally I give a personal opinion here. I believe so. I think there's still quite a lot of ice in the upper surface of Mars. We've seen it around the South Poles where we had quite a bit of permafrost. And there are also indications of water vapor and methane in combination around the equator. And I think this radar will take the understanding of planets to another level whenever it operates.
And if there is liquid water, will the radar be able to distinguish between liquid water and water ice?
Well, the radar looks at the reflection between different surfaces, interface surfaces between rock and ice or rock and water. And it's based on interpreting that reflection that any speculation would be made.
So,
liquid water will only exist on Mars when it's under substantial pressure, because the atmosphere on Mars is 1/6,000th of what we have here. That's 1/6,000th of the air pressure that we have on Earth. So consequently, the ice will go straight from ice form into vapor. It won't go through a liquid phase.
On the surface?
On the surface. It requires enormous pressure. So if there is sufficient pressure under the surface of Mars, and whatever ice is there is at the right temperature, then yes, it could exist in liquid form.
And 5 kilometers down, would the pressure be enough that if there is ice, that it would have been turned into liquid water at that depth?
It is possible.
And that's where the possibility of the methane concentrations and other gases in three areas that Dr. Formisano's work and others have been able to confirm, that there, the idea is, can you look and see if there's liquid water below those areas?
That is what we're hoping to achieve, to understand exactly what lies below the surface of Mars and in what regions. As I said earlier, there are some very significant high-priority targets that I'm sure from a scientific interest point of view, we want to go over and examine very, very carefully with the radar to try and put a better picture together, not just mapping the atmosphere and looking at the surface in three dimensions with a stereo camera, but also putting a new dimension, what is actually lying below it, what is maybe being responsible for forming some of the features that we see only on the surface at the moment.
I wonder if we can find any more anomalies with this system, Linda.
Well, I talked with Michel Denis about the question. If there were, let's say, subterranean, we'll call them chambers,
sure,
holes, would the Mars's radar be able to sort of map them out? And he said, technically, Mars's is not looking for liquid water under pressure or water ice. It's looking for these interfaces, changes in structure from something that is soft to something that is hard, or from something of a certain density to a different density. And then if Mars's ground-penetrating radar was over an area where there were big hollows and tunnels in the crust on Mars, he said Mars's should be able to differentiate, but it would appear only as transitions and structures in the radar. And then he said, we would have to go there to know for sure.
Well, unfortunately, that's at least 20 years away, isn't it?
And there is another, you might call it a strange bureaucratic fly in the ointment. Because of the year delay in getting the Mars's radar operational, the European Space Agency's budget for this operation was supposed to run out in December of 2005.
So what do they do? Just stop?
Well, they've already gone to their 15-nation constituency, and it appears that they will get a positive vote to authorize more funding for another 2 years. That would take it to December of 2007. And now here's another interesting issue. Because there are what they call eclipse seasons, that means that the orbiter will go in and out of the Martian shadow, and they call that an eclipse.
All right.
And when that happens, the spacecraft will have 1 hour of darkness, and then 6 hours of sunlight, 1 hour of darkness, 6 hours of sunlight, and this goes on and on. Well, during that 1 hour of darkness, periodically, they've got to go to battery backup. And think of your computer turning it on and off, on and off, on and off, or anything like that. And so now what they are worried about is that the lifetime left in the batteries on the Mars Orbiter Express might also expire in 2 to 3 years. And so we're sort of coming down the stretch here with this marvelous instrument, this deep ground penetrating radar.
It's been a workhorse.
With them having to go out and get more funding, with the batteries maybe expiring 2 years from now, with the hope and prayer that in these 2 years, Mars's will function perfectly and that we will learn all we can about all of Mars' crust 3 miles down all over the planet.
Linda, do you know how many objects we've lost going to Mars? I can't count them.
Several.
And now possibility of a collision, I mean, this is just too weird.
Well, it has to do apparently with orbits, you know, mechanical orbits and whatever was going on. And thank God somebody did the calculation that these three spacecraft would be coming down at the same low point at the same approximate time, that they could become within 2 kilometers of each other on May 7th of 2005, somebody did that calculation, and because they paid attention, they were able to move a spacecraft. And Denis said today that next time, because this will reoccur apparently, that this could happen again, this alleged traffic jam. And he said, they made us move the orbiter. Next time, we want NASA to move one of theirs.
So if they start penetrating with this radar and they find anomalies, let's say they stumbled into some things that back up Richard's, Hoagland's theories of underground cities and things like that, do you think they'd ever reveal that to us?
I don't personally understand how it could be kept from the public, because you've got two completely different bodies of large numbers of scientists in Europe and the United States, and with scientists collaborating with them basically around the world, you know, Italy, Holland, Germany, so many countries are involved, France. And we're talking about signals that are coming to a variety of places. I don't understand at this point how a conspiracy of information could be organized and sustained when this is such a kind of global effort.
Well, I don't know, Linda. If they want to hide it from us, they'll find a way.
Well, listen, let me, before our time is up, just give a taste of what is coming July 4th, because, boy, this is going to be another fascinating event in our solar system. It is July 4th at about 11 a.m. Pacific time.
Deep impact.
And this is deep impact, and this is with the Tempel 1 comet, and this is one of the most fascinating stories that I have ever done an interview with a scientist. I talked with Jay Malosh. He is a planetary scientist at the University of Arizona in Tucson, and he was given the assignment: how do you make a hole in the comet Tempel 1 without explosives? And what he explained to me is that this impactor, this was his baby, that they all calculated, and that the spacecraft would be moving so fast, and the impactor, when it's released, because the deep impactor mothership, he calls it, and the impactor itself, they will separate. And this is very important, because the mothership has to be staying in secure, safe distance.
It's got to be like
500 kilometers to take pictures.
Exactly. 300 is what they're shooting for, 300 miles.
The impactor is going to have a camera on it, too. And it is going to slam into this Tempel 1 comet, traveling at least 23,000 miles an hour, with a 3-foot diameter copper, I'm going to call it a shield, on the front of it. And what they've figured out, Dr. Malosh, that the amount of kinetic energy for this 820-pound mass, it looks like a bullet, is going to be 10 times more energy than an equal mass of TNT. And that they don't need to pack explosives when they can use this kind of kinetic energy. and two or three things they think.
We won't have time for the two or three things, Linda. We got to run.
Okay, it's going to be a big crater. We're going to find out what the what this big snowball is made of, and it may be just rich with scientific data.
That's Linda Moulton Howe, earthfiles.com. By the way, on July 4th, I'll be here. We'll have a live program for you, so we'll update you on whether that deep impact collision really occurred.